An artillery round exploded to Henry's right, throwing him off stride. He caught his balance and continued to run, glancing around to make sure that Merle and Carruthers were all right. They were still with him, firing their carbines as they charged toward the Yankee defensive lines. Henry waited. He would save his bullets for the last minute, when he was close enough to the enemy that he couldn't miss. Those shots might make the difference, he thought. They might allow the Confederates to break through the Federal line. At the same time, fear hammered through him, and he had to force his muscles to keep working, carrying him forward. He tried to make his mind and his feelings numb, so he would not be overwhelmed by panic. Maybe some men could go into battle without being afraid, but he wasn't one of them. He wanted to turn and run the other direction. In the end, his devotion to duty, the bond he felt with the other men, and his hatred of the Yankees and everything they had done to the South carried him ahead. Clouds of powder smoke rolled across the battlefield, choking and blinding him, but he pressed on, fighting his way through some thick brush until he saw the Union breastworks no more than 50 yards in front of him. All was chaos around him now, the air filled with the hum of flying lead and the rattle of musketry and the screams of hurt and dying men. Henry fired once, twice as he ran forward. He was blinded for a second by the smoke. Then it cleared and revealed to him the Yankees firing over the barriers of earth and stone and logs. The leading edge of the Confederate attack reached the breastworks and surged up and over them. Flags from both sides waved above the mass of fighting and dying humanity. Bits of cloth darting back and forth, weaving around each other as if they were doing battle along with the men who carried them. Henry screamed incoherently as he reached the breastworks and started to clamber up them. He thrust the pistol toward the blue-clad shapes that swam before his eyes and pulled the trigger. The gun bucked in his hand. He pulled the hammer back and fired again, repeating the near mindless action until the pistol was empty. The hammer may have clicked harmlessly on an empty chamber several times before Henry realized what was happening. He never knew for certain about that. But he knew, in this bloody madness, that he would never have a chance to reload. He jammed the empty gun behind his belt and reached for a saber some officer had dropped. Union, Confederate, it didn't matter. All that was important was that the blade was sharp enough to hack the life out of the enemy, to cut through flesh and spill blood. Henry's hand had just closed over the saber's grip when something smashed into his head and sent him tumbling backward into darkness. Farther to the west, in the center of the Union line, the vast column of gray and butternut-clad men smashed into the Federal earthworks. The left side of the Confederate advance had farther to go before reaching the Union defenses, but as the light faded and dusk settled over the landscape, that part of the advance closed with the enemy as well. The line of battle stretched for miles. It was desperate fighting, hand-to-hand clashes in the shadows. At first, as the charge began, it seemed to the defenders that the Southerners could not possibly cross so much open ground to reach them. Surely the artillery and rifle fire would break the back of the charge and repel the rebels back to the southern hills from which they advanced. But the attackers swarmed over the advance Union position and followed the retreating Federals into the heart of the Union line, their high-pitched yells providing a counterpoint to the crash of cannons and the crackle of rifles. Clouds of smoke roiled over the ground, concealing the Confederates for long moments, but when the wind cleared away those clouds, each time the line of gray was closer. With a crash like that of some primeval earthquake, the two sides were butted together. The attacking rebels at the center of the line were already in the midst of the Yankee earthworks, firing and stabbing and clubbing the defenders at close range. The Federals pulled back momentarily, then reinforcements came up, and the Union line stiffened. The Confederates fell back and charged again. The mass of men charged and charged again. Hood was ensconced at a command post atop a nearby hill, but the clouds of powder smoke and the gathering darkness prevented him from seeing how the battle was going. All he could see were distant spurts of flame from the discharge of Union guns and the fireflies of combat in the gloom. Obviously, the Yankees were putting up a heavy resistance. They would have to be swept before the victorious Army of Tennessee in order for Hood to achieve the glorious success that he so obviously, in his own mind, deserved. The attack would continue, despite the fall of darkness, just like it had 2 years ago, when Hood broke through the Union defenses at the beginning of the 7 Days battle. The key to success, then and now, was to attack and attack and attack. That was how Lee had defeated McClellan and Pope and Burnside and Hooker. That was how Hood would defeat Schofield and then Thomas. Again and again the Confederates charged over the hotly disputed ground. The fighting was the heaviest at the center of the line, but it was pure hell from one end to the other. At the very center, where the turnpike followed by Cheatham's division cut through a farm belonging to a family named Carter, Patrick Cleburne urged his men forward, fighting side by side with them like a common soldier rather than a divisional commander. A Yankee bullet struck him just below the heart, killing him instantly. Not far away, General Hiram Granbury fell dead, shot in the head. Off on the Confederate left, General Otho F. Strahl was wounded while passing reloaded rifles forward to the front. His aides sprang up to carry him to the rear, but before they could do so, Strahl was hit again, mortally this time. Brigadier General John Adams fell in the fighting, as did Brigadier General States Rights Gist. Brigadier General John C. Carter suffered a wound that would take his life several days later. Another brigadier, George W. Gordon, was captured by the Yankees. Few men realized until later that, in this battle, the commanders seemed to be in as much danger as the lowliest private or drummer boy. Many more common grade officers fell during the bloody afternoon and early evening. Colonels fell as well, as did majors and captains and lieutenants. Field command fell sometimes all the way to sergeants. Still the battle continued. Men fought blindly, unable to see much of anything because of the darkness and the smoke. But it didn't take being able to see much to thrust the barrel of a rifle over the top of the breastworks and pull the trigger. Yankees and rebels were packed so tightly, it wasn't even necessary to aim. Nearly every shot shredded flesh and smashed through bone. Before the fighting finally dwindled toward midnight, more than 1,700 men from John Bell Hood's Army of Tennessee lay dead or wounded on the plains just south of Franklin. The firing fell to sporadic exchanges between pickets, and Schofield withdrew his exhausted army to the northern bank of the Harpeth River and silently marched on to Nashville. The battle was over, but the cost for whatever Hood had won was tremendous. It was a price these gallant Southerners could scarcely afford to pay.